Welcome to the Photography Lounge, home of inspirational conversations with the world's best photographers and the leading minds from the photo industry. Brought to you by Smug Mug and Flickr, join me, your host, Alistair Jolly, as I go beyond the lens and I dive deep into the stories of what inspires and motivates the photographers and the creatives that we all love and admire. Hi folks, Alistair here with another episode of our podcast. I'm really excited to have this next conversation. Today's guest is one of the most creative individuals that I know. For the last 12 years, she has explored the light and the darkness in people, discovering, interpreting, and then portraying these themes and stories as a self-portrait artist. She's incredibly prolific, creates amazing imagery almost on a daily basis. On top of all that, she just happens to be an awesome human being and still finds time to do humanitarian work. I am thrilled to welcome Brooke Shaden.
Thank you.
Did that sound like I summed up you? It's always nice to do an intro and get the acknowledgement that it's appropriate.
Yeah.
That's how I described you, a self-portrait artist portraying these themes. Did that sound appropriate? How would you describe yourself?
Yes, very much so. I used to always get a little nervous at the title of self-portrait artist because I think there's a lot of stigma attached to that. But I guess at the end of the day, I just really don't like talking to people. So it's awesome when you get to work by yourself and make your own rules and you don't have to explain anything to anybody. And so now I totally embrace it. I love being a self-portrait artist.
That's exactly what a podcast host wants to hear.
Oh, totally.
I don't like talking to people.
Well, you know, I make special exceptions.
Shall we go back to the beginning? And tell us a little bit of how you ended up being this self-portrait artist. Is that what you aspired to be? Is that what you set out your sort of education plan to become, a self-portrait artist?
I always thought that I was going to be incredibly normal. So in my mind, there was no artistry involved in my life ever. I always thought I was going to be an English teacher. That was always my goal growing up, because my identity was wrapped up in being responsible and having a normal life and being, you know, like living in the town that I grew up in, and everything was just going to be structured and perfect. And it wasn't until I discovered filmmaking that I decided maybe I could be some sort of an artist. Mm-hmm. And I went to film school. And of course, I got a backup degree in English literature just in case.
Just the escape course.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And it really wasn't until I graduated college that I realized I didn't want to work with people. And that was a massive issue in the film world, because you have to work with a lot of people.
Huge numbers of people.
Yes. Yeah. And it was just every morning I would wake up with a stomach ache and I couldn't imagine my life like that. So I said, what could I do where I could be totally alone every single day? I wouldn't have to talk to people and I could still make art. And I figured photography was the way to go, because I could make an image that looked like a whole film in my mind, just in one frame, totally by myself, where I get to be the person choosing the theme and the colors and the wardrobe and all those decisions on a film set that get split up between hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, that sounds perfect to me. I can dream up my perfect life and then try to make it happen through photography.
It's interesting that, you know, several times that you've talked about not being with other people.
Yeah.
Some people would look at your work and think it's quite extroverted, you know, these characters and personas and the themes and the props and that type of stuff, but you're quite introverted then.
Totally introverted. And this is, I think, maybe something that a lot of artists can identify with, is this feeling like we're desperate for connection. Mm-hmm. Because so many artists are. I mean, that's why a lot of people create, because we have something to say and we would love if somebody would listen to us and hear what we have to say.
Or validate it.
Totally, yeah. Yes. But then at the same time, a lot of artists have a lot of emotions and we have a lot of, you know, feelings that we don't necessarily feel comfortable sharing with a lot of people. And I think it's just the perfect medium, especially self-portraiture, is this way to create by yourself, but not necessarily just for yourself. It's for other people at the same time.
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Who do you create it for? It is a self-portraiture. It's something you want to not do with other people, but you're still creating to share it.
Right? Yes, I very much am. And I think that throughout history, artists have been pegged as people who create for themselves and by themselves. And there's a lot of sort of, I don't know, maybe respect wrapped up in that ideal of an artist creating for themselves. But I feel like I'm an artist who is perfectly timed in history. Like, you know, some people always say like, oh, I wish I was born 100 years ago. I actually feel like I'm in the perfect moment right now because I love sharing. And I create first and foremost because I want to, but largely to be able to help people and to share, you know, some sort of common experience with people. And so I think that I used to be ashamed to say that. Like, I felt like less of an artist if I said I create for other people. But I think that it's kind of the way that art is going right now, is just this idea that we can create this sort of communal experience for people.
It's interesting, that idea of sharing, because not only do you share your artwork, you pretty much share everything you do, mm-hmm. how you do it, why you do it. And it's something you're very well known for, is this sharing of knowledge and many other things. Is that something you consciously have decided to do?
Oh, massively, yes. And I don't, I will first say that I don't look down on anybody who doesn't share, because sure. I think that that's a really personal choice. But I know that I have often felt like I didn't know where to turn for help for so many different reasons, whether it's creative or business or something else. And I just, at one point, I realized that I was really struggling with jealousy a lot in my life. And I didn't want to be that person that struggled with jealousy. And so I made a conscious choice. I thought, if I don't want to be that person, and that makes me ashamed that that is me, then I need to just do the opposite and find joy in helping other people as much as I can. And just that conscious effort to find joy in helping people made that my truth. And I started devoting my entire life to that. And every single thing that I do, whether it's creating an image or a business decision, anything, I always say, does this benefit me, but does it equally benefit other people? And if the answer is yes, then I always do it. And if the answer is no, then I really have to reevaluate why I'm making that decision.
Yeah, it's funny that, you know, again, going back to the fact that you openly say you don't want to work with people or be with people when you do it, and yet you're this person that shares with so many people around the world.
It's a huge struggle in my life.
Really?
Yeah, it is.
You physically have to work to do that?
Yeah.
Because it seems to come so naturally.
Well, it does. It comes so naturally. And I think that there's a point where there's the ideal of like, I want to create a community and I want to inspire people. And if I died tomorrow, I would want to be known for having inspired people. Mm-hmm. But then the reality is that I get overwhelmed by community and I'm uncomfortable in a group situation. I don't function well in the presence of other people. And so it's just a daily struggle to create distance from that while at the same time cultivating it. It's just a weird position.
Well, you make it look seamless and easy.
Thank you.
Even if it's an internal struggle, because people adore the work you do and the way that you give to the community, and you have a huge following and a huge community that loves your work. So the fact that you know, you have to work at that, and it is an internal struggle, I think we're even more grateful that you're willing to do it and pass on that information. So is there a normal day in Brooke's life, or is
actually very much so. I mean, I am a person all about structure and organization, and I just love a good routine. And in fact, I can't create art outside of that, really. Like, if I'm put in a situation that's not my everyday experience, I feel really out of balance and I don't create well from that place. So for me, I mean, I'm a super morning person. I love getting up really early. And I'm the type of person where I'm pretty much shut down at noon. So like, if I can get my work done by noon, then I'm good to go. And so I typically am business in the morning, and everything I don't want to do in a day, I do it first so that I don't have to think about it later. And then I do all my business things that I might have to do. And then by the time noon hits, I've really gotten a full work day in by that point. And so I just do creative stuff the whole rest of the day. And that's kind of how I structure my days. And they're all very different, of course, for anybody who has many different facets of their business, that it'll be the case. But for the most part, I stick to a really good schedule, and I love a schedule.
It's funny. Yeah. I mean, as creatives, we're all so different. I personally function better in the evening.
Yeah.
Certainly not a morning person.
Yeah.
Talking to so many creatives, our brains are all wired differently. Mm-hmm. And you have to find that path that suits yourself.
Well, and that's exactly, I love that you brought that up, because so many people have said to me, and I just hear in general, you know, to succeed, you have to be a morning person, or to succeed, you have to get up early and really, you know, like seize the day. And I always just, I wish that people would embrace whatever, you know, routine they like, that they naturally gravitate toward. If you want to be up till 4 a.m. creating stuff, then do it, because that's the time that you get into your flow. And I just wish more people would recognize their own, you know, perfect schedule and follow that instead.
Yeah, we're all so different, and mm-hmm. you have to embrace that we are all wired slightly differently. Yeah. Many people will know the name Chris McCaskill, who's one of the founders of Smug Mug, and he recently did a TED Talk. And his TED Talk was about your difference is your superpower.
Yeah.
And we are all different, and that's what makes us, you know, powerful, and we have to embrace it. And yeah, I definitely don't embrace early morning.
And I don't embrace the night, so I hear you.
Okay, well, we'll get this done quickly then.
Yes.
I'll get the hint. So you are very structured, and you're very aware of the things that need done.
Yes.
On a business level.
Mm-hmm.
And you create all every day? Do you reckon you create
largely
something?
Yeah. And I guess that sometimes I use that word loosely, because there are days where I'll write a grant proposal mm-hmm. and I will feel so accomplished and creative by the end of that process that I'll feel like, I can't believe I made that. And then I think to myself, oh right, that's not actually making art. But to me, it's like the same muscles in your brain that you're using to find a different way of seeing the world and then articulating that somehow. And so even though I'm not necessarily taking a picture every day, I still feel like I'm creating something every day that I'm proud of. But I would say that I'm shooting or sculpting or doing something really creative probably 3 to 4 times a week. And then the rest of the days are just super business creativity.
Yeah, but every day you're working on your craft.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
And that's something a lot of people need to realize, that, you know, as a business person and trying to make a living from your creativity, mm-hmm. unfortunately, it doesn't mean touching a camera every day or taking
right.
an image or creating an image every day. But every day you work is, you know, part of your craft.
Yes.
And, you know, it's something you share a lot of. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned there you're working every day, and you mentioned writing grant applications and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's hard, this business,
yes.
trying to make money.
Yes.
People will look at how successful you've been and think, oh, you must be inundated with work.
And right, right.
Constantly people asking you to create for them or license right. or whatever. But you quite clearly work very hard at bringing opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest questions that I get regularly is, how do you get brands to come to you, or how do you get publishing companies, or, you know, all these things. And I always laugh at that, because I say, why do you think they're coming to me? I'm going to them, you know, and that's the work that I think people are really hesitant to talk about, is like the effort that they put into finding those jobs for themselves. And not that that's necessarily how everybody does it, but I have certainly spent countless hours writing, you know, random emails to every publishing company I could find, and music groups and brands and just different companies. And you know, 99% of the time I hear nothing back from those people, but every once in a while you do. And that's how I've gotten almost all the jobs I've had.
I mean, the reality is we'd all love to just be artists and just create all day and,
right.
and to, you know, I'll make it and they shall turn up kind of thing. But, you know, the reality is we're business owners mm-hmm. and we have to be salespeople. Every
yes.
every organization needs a salespeople and a marketing team.
Exactly.
A finance team. And at some point you get to take an image or two. And it sounds like you have a lot of process and, you know, hard work ethic at making sure that you fulfill all those roles.
Right. And for me, it's actually a really easy thing to do, because I consider business, marketing, branding, and creativity to fall all under the same title of just controlling your narrative, mm-hmm. whether it's art or business or something else. And so when I when I look at a business choice I want to make, or even a piece of art I want to create, the question is, what is the narrative that I'm forming around this? And then how can that benefit other people? So when I write to a company or a gallery or something like that, my question is never, how can I get them to take my work and sell it? It's, how can I get them to understand the story that I'm telling and then make them care about it? And that really makes such a difference in how you pitch to people and how you get people to support your work or purchase your work or anything.
Yeah. And if that organization or that gallery gets that and mm-hmm. understands the work you're doing, then you know they're going to be able to represent you
yes.
in a genuine and authentic way.
Yes.
And hopefully convert that into revenue.
Yes, that is the goal, isn't it?
The goal is always revenue. Yeah. As much as we'd all love to just have people enjoy our artwork, we have to pay the bills.
Yes.
Right. I once read a comment that you made that resonated very deeply with me. You made this comment about how when you mentioned that you're a creative who works at home, mm-hmm. a lot of people don't recognize it as a real job.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's been a big issue lately. Huge.
Who are those people?
So a couple of months ago, I began fostering in, at least in the US, the foster system is where you take in children who need a home temporarily. And throughout that process, over the last couple of months, I've had a lot of random people in my house who have sure. lots of opinions about parenting, and every one of them has said to me, well, thank goodness you work from home so you can be a stay-at-home parent and take care of these children full time. And my response initially was, sure, I can do that. And then you very quickly realize that there is no working at home when you have a two-year-old running around the right. house. And I never really thought about how stigmatized it is to mm-hmm. work from home. I mean, people just think you're doing nothing all day, essentially. And so I've been really vocal lately with all these people coming into my home and saying, you know, actually, I'm the main breadwinner for my house and I work a very full-time job
yep.
plus. And that's just been a weird experience for me. I did not expect that. And I didn't expect the shame that comes with that. You know, the looks that people give me when I say, oh, well, actually, I'm going to look into daycare and actually I need to work. And that's just been wild.
Yeah, and yet the reality was if you were a foster mother who did have a day job in an office, they wouldn't think twice
completely.
About daycare or
yeah.
the fact you weren't going to be there. But the fact that you're at home and you're a creative, mm-hmm. Then you know there's this yeah. idea that, oh, well, she can just be there all the time. And
yeah, and even really. From the earliest parts of this process, I remember right when we started getting licensed for foster care, the big conversation was we had to do a whole bunch of classes. And I said, well, actually, I have to travel a lot for my work. And they said, well, what are you doing for your work? And I said, well, sometimes photo shoots and sometimes lectures. And they said, well, you don't have to do that. And they just couldn't fathom that that was work, you
yeah.
know? And they kept saying, well, you know, it's really valid if somebody has to go to a job, you know, at a mine for 2 weeks or
right.
like that was their example,
yeah.
you know? And I said, okay, but you know.
Never mind the revenue stream. Like this is important for our revenue stream, which is going to support this new
exactly,
family.
Exactly, exactly.
You don't need to do that.
Yeah, so much stigma there. It's really bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, during my photo career, I was very fortunate to always work from home. And you know, a lot of people say, oh, you're so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
You get to work at home
mm-hmm.
in your pajamas.
Right.
Watching Netflix. And I was like, no, I get up every morning and I dress, get clean, get dressed, go into my office, my space,
yeah, exactly.
which is my office, and do work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, one day you'll get a real job.
Right, exactly.
I hope that it's never true that I get a real job in that sense then, if that's...
May we all never get real jobs.
So you mentioned there that you've recently become a foster parent, which is hugely commendable and
thank you.
For and grateful that there are people in the world like yourself willing to do that. Obviously, it's a big change becoming a parent.
Huge change.
And for someone who is so into their business routine mm-hmm. and so prolific at creating and working on their craft, it's been an adjustment, I'm sure.
Yeah, a huge adjustment. And one that I thought I was prepared for and then realized I'm not. And that's been a great discovery in a lot of ways, because I feel like part of my job, as an artist is to know myself really deeply. And I had started to feel like, wow, I've really done a lot of work there. What's next? Like, what am I going to explore next? And for some reason, I just didn't see becoming a parent as the next thing to explore, which seems very obvious now. And I've been just shocked at how rocked my world is and how everything is different. Nothing has remained the same. But that said, I am very structured and really on the ball as much as I can be. And so I, in August last year, I batch created over 80 pieces of content that I could release over the course of 6 months so that I wouldn't have to work if I couldn't. And it's been a lifesaver.
So that's a lot of upfront preloading of the work so that you can schedule that out.
It was a lot. It was a lot. I spent about a month and a half creating the content. And I took a few days to just map out every piece of content that I wanted to create, whether it was topics for a blog post, videos that I wanted to create, photo challenges, images, stuff like that. And then I scheduled it all out for a few weeks. And I one day I filmed 25 videos in one day just to get all that done in one day. It was very difficult finding that many outfits. I kept changing every single time. And
trying to make it look like a new day in each.
Exactly. Yeah, I think people are tricked. I think it's working. So I ended up filming, I think, 35 videos and writing over 50 blogs and just putting together all these graphics for social media. And all in all, it took about a month and a half to do. But then I had 6 months worth of content where I could release 4 new things a week for 6 months straight. And it's been incredible. And I did it knowing I would become a parent soon. Mm-hmm. So I would have that time. But now that I've done it, I can't even imagine going back. I just keep thinking, okay, May is coming and I'm going to, you know, I'm going to batch more content and keep going with this.
So this is the new plan.
It's the new plan. Yeah. It's an amazing plan because you get into creative flow when you're Absolutely. Really hyper-focused like that. So instead of every week trying to push yourself to think, okay, now what's the next thing I'm going to put out there? Instead, just wait till you get that flow and then just run with it and make that content and get ready. And then if a week comes and you're like, you know, I'm inspired to do something else, do it. You don't have to release that content, but it's there. And there's so much security in that. Sure. You know, because so many people are just so afraid of social media for so many reasons. And the constant thing that I hear is, well, I can't keep up. How am I going to create all the time? And well, don't create all the time. Create when you feel like it and really be prolific during that time and then let yourself rest for a while and that's okay.
Rest and refresh. And
yeah.
That's revolutionary.
It's amazing. I mean, I'm so passionate about this because I think that if more people worked when they felt like it and didn't when they didn't feel like it, then things would be so much better for everybody.
A couple of years ago now, we acquired Flickr under the Smug Mug brand. And that's when we first really started communicating about working together. Mm-hmm. And just at that point, if you remember, you were celebrating, I think, 10 years since your first image had been uploaded.
Yeah.
And we had some fun reimagining that. Do you remember that?
Oh my gosh, yes. And that was such an important moment for me because Flickr was... it was everything to me. When I started photography, I would not go more than like 2 hours without checking Flickr. And my community was there and I started my career there and I was able to make an income because of Flickr. And it was just it defined an era of my life in so many ways. And so to connect with you and be able to come full circle 10 years later and say, oh my gosh, let's celebrate together. It was the best feeling.
It was really wonderful timing to celebrate that. So maybe we can tell the listeners just what we did with that first image.
Yeah, so I looked at the very first image that I ever took, which was my first image on Flickr, and thought, well, it's been a decade. So what would I do with this concept now? Like if I could just go back and recreate this after 10 years of experience, what would that look like? And so we did a couple of different photo shoots actually to try to reimagine that and figure out how has my style evolved? How has that concept evolved? And that very first image that I ever made, it was called If I Should Die Before I Wake, based on a prayer that my grandmother used to say to me that always terrified me. And I thought,
just before you went to sleep.
Exactly. I mean, I thought, what a terrifying thing to think about. And so, so it was, if I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. And I just would think, oh my gosh, I hope that I don't die in my sleep, because what a terrifying thought to me. And so that was my very first image that I ever made, was a sort of a clone image where I was handing a ball of light to my other self and sort of handing off my soul. And so I reimagined that 10 years later. And what I learned actually from that is that there's so much that you learn about yourself just through the recreation process, but also that in a lot of ways, going back to a concept and reimagining it is, I guess it's less rewarding than I thought in some ways, mm-hmm. because I felt like, no, I really had moved on from that. And that's a great feeling to acknowledge that 10 years on, or however many years on you are, that maybe you have left that behind, and maybe you've said what you had to say, and you're moving into a new era of your life. So yeah. It felt like perfect closure to do that and then say, now I'm ready for the next thing.
Reimagining it and realizing you'd closed that chapter
exactly. Initially
anyway.
Yeah.
And the prayer that you mentioned, mm-hmm. if there's any Metallica fans out there, it features in the song Enter Sandman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Showing my heavy metal roots. But yeah, if anybody wants to check out, we did make a little film about reimagining of that image 10 years on. So you'll find that on the Flickr YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go watch that. But it was a lot of fun seeing the process and seeing how you work through that sort of visualization of what you want to do. It's slightly different from your typical work, because it was a reworking of an initial image. But yeah, it's maybe something I would encourage the listeners to do, is, you know, look back early work and, one, trying to reimagine it, but also, you know, look at how far you've come.
Yes.
You know, everyone has improved. I hear a lot of people recently saying, oh, I've went back to my Flickr account and, oh my goodness, I don't want to look at it, it's so bad. But celebrate that.
My gosh, yes. I wish that, you know, I think that there's a huge trend of people saying, well, I'm going to delete that old work because it's so bad. And
no.
I mean, I sometimes pull up the images that I know are the most embarrassing pictures I've ever taken. And I never feel more proud than when I look at those images, because even though I recognize they're silly or they're poorly done or something, at least I did it. And at least I had the guts to put it out there and keep it there too. Like to say, this is a valid part of my journey and I'm not going to just erase that. I'm going to celebrate that I did it and I put it there and people had opinions about it and they were bad and they were good and they were everything in between. But it's there and we can all go back and look at that. And oh, I just think that's my favorite thing.
I wish any of my work was as bad as your own work.
Well, thank you. But there are some cringeworthy images in there, which everybody can see because I'm not deleting them.
Yeah, but you know, you look at any of the great masters, you know, nobody goes back to their first pieces of work and says, oh, that's not worth money, because it's, you know, it's actually even more valuable because you see the progression and the techniques and the learnings that they had in those early pieces of work.
And you also never know how you're impacting other people with that work. You might be embarrassed by it, but someone might be just hugely impacted by that, which was a lesson that I learned on Flickr in my first year of creating. I made a picture that I just thought, oh, this was really bad and maybe I shouldn't have posted this online, and I deleted it. And it was the first time I had ever done that. And the next day someone messaged me and said, where's that picture that I saw yesterday? I can't find it. And I said, oh, I took it down. It wasn't very good. And she said, well, you know, I just went through a miscarriage last week and it was the first thing that made me feel understood. And I felt just awful that I deleted it, because I'm selfishly thinking, oh, people probably don't like this, when in fact it was really deeply touching somebody. And ever since that moment, I just thought, I'm never going to assume that my art is just for me. It's for other people too. And if I'm going to put that out there, then I need to release it. Just let it go and let it belong to everybody and not just myself.
Yeah, but belong to those people that it resonates with or see something. And that's the beautiful thing about art in general, is we all resonate and we all love different things.
Yeah.
And there's a space for all of us.
Yes.
You know, and there's a need for everybody to celebrate what they think is the good and the bad, because it will be the opposite for someone else.
Yeah. And you know, like, there are images that I can very clearly see our ridiculous images that I made in the past, probably objectively, but we'll just say subjectively. But nonetheless, just that, just creating that work, putting it out there, letting that exist, as good or bad as it may be, gives other people permission to create work that might not be perfect, but maybe as a reminder that we're not creating to be perfect. We're creating to create. And I think that a lot of the joy of the process is lost when we think that everything has to be so good. It just doesn't.
Yeah. And maybe you look at a piece of work and you think technically I could improve on the technicalities of it.
Right.
But, you know, the theme or the story or the concept is still as relevant today as it was back then.
Yeah.
You know? I mentioned in my introduction about, on top of all the things you've just mentioned, this, you know, high productivity level, super early morning structured person, the amazing step you've taken to become a foster parent. On top of all that, you still find time to do humanitarian work. And, you know, it's something I would love to take some time to talk about. And that's the light space.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I started, I met this amazing woman named Laura Price, and we met 8 years ago or so. And she reached out totally out of the blue and just said, I teach creative workshops, or I host creative workshops in India for the sex trafficking community. And would you be willing to come teach photography? And we didn't know each other. So we met and we had a quick conversation. And by the end of it, I said, okay, let's book my ticket and I'll go. And so we did. And I went to India that year and I taught self-expression workshops through self-portraiture. And it was a life-changing experience for myself and for the people involved. Everyone had a really transformative time. And I started going year after year to India and teaching the same workshops to different groups. And at some point, we kind of said, well, this is awesome that we can do this. And I'm spending, you know, a few weeks every year there. But it didn't feel like it was a lasting impact. I mean, I knew that I was giving people the tools to express themselves, but then we'd take the camera away. Right. And what are they going to do then? And so we said, let's do something long-term and really teach photography as a vocation where, you know, people within these communities who are vulnerable to trafficking have something to put on their resume, have a creative outlet, have real proper training, and just see if that leads to jobs in the market. And so we started a photography school called The Light Space that runs in India, Thailand, and Greece. And Greece is our newest chapter that's going amazingly well. So we're working with refugees in Greece. And we currently... we're kind of growing a little too fast in Greece and we're working on that. But we've had 100 students this year come through and we're working with a proper school in Greece now as part of their normal curriculum to add that in. And it's been amazing. We've had a couple of exhibitions with all the students' work. And it's great because, of course, they're building a resume. They're getting an official certificate saying, I've done this training. But the best part is just watching them see their own art on the walls and people are buying it. And they feel so validated in their voice. And these are people who have, you know, fled from horrors that we can't even imagine. And they haven't had any stability like that. So for them to be able to go to a school and have this program and then walk away saying, people bought my art and people came and looked at it. And it's amazing. I mean, how incredibly empowered they are after that.
Absolutely. Life-changing for these people. So it's amazing that you do that. What compels you to add that to the workload that you've already got?
Well, I do a lot of work and research about legacy, and it's a huge topic in my brain all the time. And I know that a lot of people get really anxious at the word legacy because it's a big word. And so I guess we can boil that down to purpose if that doesn't resonate. But I think a lot about, if I were to die tomorrow, what do I want to be known for? And I mean, it's actually the reason why I don't really consider myself a photographer exactly, because that's a word that feels too limiting to me. And I don't really care about photography. And I started to realize that, like, the thing that always defined me as a photographer, I don't really care to be called a photographer. So what do I care about? And I just want to give people tools to express themselves. And that's really what guides every decision that I make, every business decision, every creative decision is just going back to, will this inspire people to express themselves more? And if it does, then I do it. And I guess, you know, my initial work in India got me thinking about that a lot. How can I help this group and that group? And so I guess at this point in my life, I just think so much about impact and how can I make one small choice that will impact the most people in the most positive way. And just feels really important.
I had a very special and influential person in my life who used to have this phrase, life's about how you live your dash.
Mm.
And you know, when you see someone's life and you say, born this date, dash, died this date.
Yes.
He used to say, life's about how you live the dash.
Oh, that's beautiful.
And it's kind of that legacy statement of, you know, how you live that, your life is your legacy, and what you're doing is you know, is a legacy already. You know, the fact that you have these humanitarian projects and you're impacting all these lives, you're impacting people in the creative industry. You should be very proud of how you're living your dash.
Thank you. Yeah. That means a lot.
You know, there's so much more we can talk about, and you know, we've already covered so much. There's so much that you pack into this little dash and this life that you're leading. So, because you also do workshops and tours.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I do, and that's another way that I feel like it's so important to share every little bit of what I know, even when what I know changes and morphs into other things. And I don't believe in, you know, hoarding secrets or anything like that. And like I said, I mean, if that's your thing that you don't want to share, fine, that's fine. But I just don't see any of it as precious. And I think, you know, a lot of photographers mistakenly, I believe, associate their techniques with what makes them special. And in some cases that may be true, but anybody can learn any technique. And I'm highly aware of that because I am not a technical person, yet somehow I learned Photoshop. So I know it can be done by the vast majority of people. And thinking about that, how accessible technique is, I just feel like the techniques are not the thing that I need to hold back. So I share everything that I possibly can in the hope that it inspires somebody to, you know, create whatever they feel they need to create.
Yeah. I mean, you can share every ounce of technique and talent that you have, but they'll never be Brooke Shaden.
Right.
And what you want to do is inspire them to be that person.
So yeah, exactly.
There's nothing to be afraid in sharing work and sharing your stuff because you're uniquely you.
Yeah.
And people won't have the same vision and the same drive and stuff. So,
and you know, the work of being an artist is about being 10 steps ahead of yourself anyway. So, you know, I can share what I'm doing today, but my brain is already thinking about how I'm going to push myself further tomorrow. So
it's a bit like being a parent too, by the way, being 10 steps ahead.
Yes, I'm learning that very quickly. I think I'm 5 steps behind right now, but I'll get there.
you mentioned earlier that, you know, you were amazed and traumatized and stuff by what it's like trying to be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
That goes for all parents, irrelevant to the fact that you're, you know, a new foster mother. Doesn't matter at what stage you're at, it is traumatizing, and most of us fell at least 5 steps behind. So,
yeah.
So back to the workshop, the tours that you do, what do people experience on these workshops?
Well, not what they expect, I'll tell you that, which is my specialty. Whenever I do a workshop or a lecture or go on tour or anything like that, my goal is to get people to dig deeper in themselves than they ever have before in a very short period of time. Because like I said, I mean, I'm happy to share techniques and all of that, but having a real experience in your own thoughts, in your own body, in your own mind, that is so much more valuable than anything else. So every one of my lectures or whatever I happen to be doing, it's always sort of a little dive into how can you inhabit your mind and your creativity and your identity even more. And then how can we pull that out to create something more meaningful for yourself and for other people? So I do a lot of work like that with people. Just how do you dig deeper? How do you turn that into something tangible? But I also, I mean, I love teaching about everything, you know, like how can you then make money from that thing that you've just created? And how can you create a sustainable life and a career that feels manageable? And oh gosh, I just love teaching. I really do.
Well, it's important that people learn how to make money from it. I think, you know, back when I was at photography school, I was amazed that I left and had been taught no business skills whatsoever. And I'm actually horrified to find out that nowadays it's still the same as a whole.
Yes.
You're very much taught how to be a creative and taught the techniques and the history. What you really need to do is be taught how to sell yourself and market yourself.
Yes.
And learn how to price work and how to work out the cost of living. It's a shame that those things are still missing. So the fact that you include that is super valuable.
And it's my favorite thing. And it's kind of funny because people very rarely ask me about business. And I think that it's because my business is so wrapped up in who I am that people don't really see me as having a business very much. And that's great.
It's because you work from home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm doing nothing every day as it is. So, I think that there's this kind of invisible business that's going on with what I do. And that's what I love to teach is like, how can you take control of your narrative, pitch that narrative to people, get people on board with, you know, the story that you're telling so that you can create a business out of that, make money from it, and et cetera. So yeah, it's one of my favorite topics. And I'm always telling people, I wish people would ask me more about business because it's like my favorite thing to think about.
Well, there you go. If you're listening and you're going in one of the workshops with Brooke, make sure to be the first to ask her to talk about business.
I'll give you a big hug.
Bonus points for that one. So do you have, you know, obviously you've spoke about, you know, banking all this content late last year in order to give you that space this year to have a, you know, the things that you need to do this year. Are you doing tours and workshops this year as well?
I am a little bit. I host a convention every year called Promoting Passion. So I'm hosting that in the fall in September. It's a 3-day event all focused on art and just being a weirdo, you know, like in a really good way. So I'm hosting that. And I have a number of, you know, do you ever say to yourself, I'm going to really take a break? And then you realize that's not happening at all. That's how I am right now. So I'm traveling a lot less right now, but I have a book coming out soon. So I've been working on that and I'm hosting this convention and I'm creating an inspiration deck of cards that I'll be releasing in the fall as well, which is sort of just a little deck of cards that people can pull out and get inspired by, find ideas with. And I'm working on a new series right now that debuts in May, and that's a big chunk of time that it's taking as well.
Brooke, can you imagine how much you'd get done this year if you didn't take a break?
The amount
of stuff you just mentioned, most people would be grateful if they could do that in 5 years full time, and you're talking about taking a break this year.
The reason why I have all this on my plate is because I really prepared to be able to manage that this year. So, you know, for the first time I hired an event manager for my convention, and I got a great publisher for my book who's taking care of a lot of things, a business partner for the inspiration deck that I'm creating, and I'm all alone for my series, but at least that's fun.
So when is the convention?
It's in September, 14th to the 18th.
And where?
In Tucson, Arizona.
And where can people find out more about it?
There will be information on promotingpassion.com.
So you do visit a lot of dark places in your work.
Yeah.
Is that something you've always been into, that kind of almost horror?
Yeah. Yes and no. I'm scared of everything. Everything. I mean, I will not watch anything on TV if it's even remotely scary. In fact, if somebody even says the word ghost in a show, even if it's a joke, I will turn it off because it just sets my imagination going. I hate it. So I have a lot of just ridiculous fears. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I create dark work, because it's, you know, you have your own control over it. But I also think it's wildly beautiful. And I have for a really long time. I remember being in high school and writing a short story about like these blood cells that like tried to brainwash this girl that would like fall out of her head and out of her nose, and she would have all these nosebleeds. And I remember reading this story in front of the class, and like everybody just stared at me like they thought I was nuts. And that was the first time I'd ever really shared something like that. And but thankfully that was just fuel for me. I was like, oh, you don't like that? Well, watch me. I'm gonna do more of this. And so yeah, I've just always found anything dark to be just incredibly beautiful. And I mean, this comes from so many different things in my life. Just, I mean, like watching my cat die when I was 11, like that was an impactful experience for me that I found really beautiful, even though it was really upsetting. And I started to notice in my adulthood that those moments that I had surrounding death or grief or just dark stuff, I realized that it wasn't very normal that I really enjoyed those moments in my life in some way, you know, not that I wasn't horribly upset by them as well, but I just found it beautiful. And I think once you kind of put that together in your adult life of the moments that set you apart as a child, and you can start to build those into your art, then that's really where the magic is. That's where your voice comes from. So I've always really intentionally created dark work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I know other photographers that specialize in kind of horror genre, but they also tend to love everything about horror genre and watch horror movies and stuff. You're very different then.
Gosh, I just hate it. I mean, I'm a really excessively happy person a lot of the time, and really don't fit the bill for somebody who would create like that. But I think there's also some magic in that. And it also fits my personality because I'm super analytical. So, you know, even if I'm going through a difficult time in my life, like a couple years ago, I was sort of trapped in this cycle of grief for whatever reason. And I realized that I couldn't create from that space. Like I needed distance from that and to analyze it and to be happy to create. And so the series I'm working on now is all about death and grief from that time in my life, but I couldn't make it when I was in it. Mm-hmm. And so I like to distance myself from my inspirations and really understand them before I act on them.
Have you ever created something and went, oh no, too dark?
No, never. But I will say that there's a difference between thinking something's too dark and thinking something isn't tasteful.
Yeah.
So there are times when, you know, I've experimented with fake blood or something like that. And every time I do, I just think that's not quite what I'm going for. I'm going for disturbing. I'm not going for disgusting. Yeah. You know, and there's kind of a difference there.
Of course. So, yeah. Have you ever created anything extremely happy in your work?
I thought that I have, but nobody agrees with me. You know, it's like, well, it's happy for me, I think. So yeah, I have a couple of images, and there's even one that I made once where it's an image of me in a field, and I have a paintbrush, and I'm sort of painting a sunset into the sky, and I thought it was really happy. Of course, I added little drips of red paint just so it would look bloody a little bit, but I still thought it was really happy. And I remember taking that image to Greece when I was teaching this class to some of the refugees that I work with there. And I was so excited because I thought, oh, I'm going to finally like show this happy image. And they were all horrified by this picture. And I said, why this one? I mean, I've showed you so many creepy pictures. And they said, well, this one looks like there are bombs going off in the picture. And then I thought, well, that's their experience. Yeah. And so it's so interesting how different cultures, different experiences just bring a totally different interpretation to an image.
And, you know, your interpretation, you know, me saying the word anything happy, it's all up for interpretation, right?
Of course,
you know, all your work might create you happy because, one, you created the vision you had, and the second, it came out the way you wanted it to, and that makes you happy, and people resonate it, and there's you making something that is you perceive as happy, and other people see the, you know, interpret the horror in it from their situation.
Well, what I've always found very interesting, I've always created work that's pretty polarizing. Like, people really genuinely hate it when they don't like it, and people really genuinely love it when they do, and there's not a lot of in between. And what I've always found interesting is that the people who hate it think that it's just dark and disturbing and upsetting, but the people who love it see all the hope in it. And so there's an interesting division that happens. And I find that the people that hate it because it's too dark will often find that later in their life, they can relate to it in a different way, depending on different experiences that they've had. And even people that liked it at first will sometimes go the other way, depending on their experiences. So I always create with the intent of putting hope in the darkness. That's always my intent. And that doesn't always translate for people, and that's okay.
What's the craziest, weirdest situation you've ever put yourself in? I've seen many behind the scenes images of the work you do, you know, and there's certainly situations I've looked at and thought, I would never put myself in that thorny bush.
Yes.
Semi-naked or whatever. Yeah. What would be the standout craziest thing you think you've ever done?
Well, I mean, I have had a lot of situations where I've been alone in nature where maybe that was a bad choice. Mm-hmm. Like I remember going out and it was nearly dark and I knew it was too late for the photo shoot, but I did it anyway. And I started wrapping my head in red yarn and realized that I couldn't see because it was so dark, but I was still shooting and I couldn't get the yarn off my head. And I was just making it tighter and tighter and tighter around my neck. And I forgot scissors and I had to drive home like that because it got stuck that way. And so there are moments like that that are like, that was not smart. I shouldn't have done that. But the worst one was when I went to Target and I started looking for jars that would fit on my head. People love to watch me in stores. It's always entertaining.
Do you get followed by security quite a lot in places?
Oh, sometimes I have, yes. And so I started trying jars on my head to see if I could fit in them. And I finally found one that I fit in and I took it home and I filled it with, I guess, water and soy milk or something. And I did a back bend off of my couch and dipped my head upside down in the jar of water, which is so much worse than you even think it's going to be, because you can't go perfectly upside down into water without getting water up your nose. And on second thought, well, your head is upside down in a glass jar, which you can't really get out of very easily. And so that was definitely the scariest photo shoot that I've ever done, because I knew that, you know, to get my head out of that jar, if I couldn't go straight out, just like I went in, because I barely fit, I would have to lift the whole jar up with me, you know, and that was going to hurt as well. So it was really terrifying. And I had my husband sitting on my legs so that I wouldn't flip over the couch when I went backwards. And I had my remote in my hand, just hoping that I was triggering the camera while my head was in that jar. And it was awful. It was
Did it work?
I love that picture. I can't look at it because it's really disturbing to me. But yeah, it worked. And but I won't do it again.
Yeah, I just have to say, you know, do not try this at home, kids.
No, please don't. Please don't.
And definitely don't do those type of things alone.
No, and that's what I've learned, is I'm so careful these days to always tell somebody where I'm going, what I'm wearing, how long I'm going to be there, things like that. And I carry a whistle with me. And I try to take care of myself. But people always think I'm out on these super remote locations. But actually, I'm usually just right off of a hiking trail or something like that, and just making it look really wildernessy and secluded.
Yeah, that's the magic and the smoke and the mirrors. But we've heard a lot recently about, you know, people doing silly things, and unfortunately some people losing their lives for the gram, you know.
Yes. Getting
no image is worth
never
your life.
Never.
You know, you don't want to shorten that dash by doing doing something silly. But it's great that we can express ourselves in these ways, but you know, buddy up, people.
Yes, please.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
I've
been really looking forward to having this conversation for such a long time. And we've been very fortunate to have wonderful conversations before this one. So it's great that we had the opportunity to record this one. I just want to finish up by, you know, giving you an opportunity to let whoever's been living under a rock that doesn't know who you are, where they can go to find out a little bit more about you.
Yeah, well, I've got my website, brookshaden.com, and I'm really active on Instagram. My handle is just @brookshaden. That's where I share a lot of behind the scenes stuff, editing tips and tricks and stuff like that. And I'm on YouTube as well, with that batched content, releasing all those videos. And so that's @brookshaden. I'm on Flickr, which is @brookshaden. And that's where you can see every single image that I've ever made for the past 11 years there. And that's the only place that I really keep my whole entire body of work. So
does it feel like 11 years?
No, it doesn't at all feel like 11 years. But that's good, because, you know, my whole philosophy is that you just have to keep chasing your curiosity. And when you do that, nothing ever feels like a long time, I think.
What do you think will be in Brooke's life in the 11 years and from now in the future?
It's going to get creepier. I know that. I'm sure of that.
It's going to get darker and darker.
Just get darker, yeah. But I think for me, that's also joy. So I'm just going to keep creating. And I don't even know if I'll keep making pictures, you know, a decade from now. But that doesn't really matter. I'll still be making something.
Still be creating. Mm-hmm. Well, we look forward to continuing to watch as you move forward with your work. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, Brooke. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're laughing because there's a dog barking. We're
in a hotel room. We're
22 stories high in Vegas in a hotel room, and there's a dog barking. Do you think it's outside?
I don't think it's next door.
It's Vegas. Who knows? Anything can happen in Vegas. There's a dog hanging.
It's probably under the bed over here. I don't know.
It's probably a little handbag. Dogs. A huge thank you to Brooke for joining us on this episode. Don't forget to check out smugmug.com and flickr.com for all the latest news on our products. And come back and join us here next time at the Photography Lounge.